The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Welcome back to Global Reach, the show that helps your business deal with the risks and opportunities in the global marketplace. And in that global marketplace, payments are the lifeblood of any business. We're in the midst of a payments revolution that's pitting banks against mobile telecommunications companies, against traditional card companies, with our businesses, especially the retail businesses, often caught in the middle. It's a global revolution, and innovation is bubbling up around the world. But the countries that are on the cutting edge might surprise you. My guest, Deborah Baxley, a principal with Capgemini Financial Services and co-founder of NiPay, is going to talk about how payments are evolving in different markets, what it takes for a country to be on the innovation edge, and what this all means for your global business. Deborah, welcome to Global Reach.
Thanks very much, Tam. Delighted to be here.
My guest is recognized for her insights in the future of the payments industry. She's a payments guru with 25 years of consulting experience and in-depth experience in mobile payments and credit cards. She's a former leader of IBM's global credit card practice. In fact, she defined its credit card strategy for China. She's worked in 14 different countries advising on product direction, competitive positioning, and her knowledge extends way beyond the card industry, although her clients have included MasterCard, Bank America, Visa, and American Express. She's also a prolific author and a frequent and extremely interesting keynote speaker at events all over the world, most recently in France. So, Deborah, we all know there's a payments revolution, but you say that mobile payments are the most revolutionary event in the history of finance. Why?
Well, when you think about it, and you see these various tracking of how long it's taken technologies to be adopted, you know, people look at the radio and the TV and the internet, and mobile phones have had the fastest uptake globally of any new technology ever. So very shortly, we will have nearly 100% penetration of mobile phones around the planet. And so it'll be the first truly ubiquitous device for all of mankind, not just the developed world. And, you know, we have smartphones in the U.S. and other developed markets, but what they call the feature phones, which, you know, they're not necessarily smartphones, they're still connected computers, and they allow, you know, ubiquitous transactions, unique in time and space, compared with all of human history. It's just, you know, it's a very exciting revolution for a lot of things, including finance, and some of the things, you know, that I've studied and talked about really make people's lives better. So in developed markets, mobile phones, you know, they make things maybe more cool, sexy, interesting, fun to shop. But for some people in developing markets in Africa, India, et cetera, it really makes a tremendous difference in their lives. In fact, one of the pundits from South Africa said that M-Pesa, which is one of the most widely adopted mobile payments schemes, which is in Kenya, has eliminated highway robbery compared to the way people used to have to send money. They sent cash.
That's really interesting, Deborah. We're going to get to Kenya and Africa a little bit later.
Okay.
So mobile payments, because the mobile phone is so universally adopted, has made this revolution in finance.
Okay, but we've got telcos. What happens? We've got the traditional bank model for transactions. We still have cash. What's pitting the banks against the telcos?
That's been the one thing that has stifled innovation in many markets is, I guess you'd call it an industry deadlock between various stakeholders that are not accustomed to working together. Banks have, you know, they have to work with some stakeholders, but they've never had to work with mobile operators and vice versa. So the business model issue is what has been most difficult to solve, not the technology, between mobile operators, telephone companies, and banks. And
okay, so
the thing is
that we'll talk about business model. What's pitting the consumer against the banks or the merchant against the banks and the telcos?
Right. Well, they need to figure out how they're each going to make money. And then the consumers, basically distrust of banks has risen a lot because of the, recent financial meltdown. Consumers very unhappy about fees. And similarly with merchants, also very unhappy about fees. And that's all over the world that merchants, don't feel like the fees that they have to pay to accept, payment cards are, you know, that they're getting their money's worth. They basically feel like they're handed these fees and they have no opportunity to be at the table to, you know, negotiate. They feel like, you know, they're just backed into a corner.
One of the things everybody talks about is legacy infrastructure. Can you define that?
Well, it's, you know, something that we've had working for the past 20, 30 years, like our Magstripe legacy infrastructure, POS devices, you know, the credit card networks. It all works very well. So in some ways, legacy in many, you know, in every instance can be kind of a double-edged sword.
Why?
It works well for you, but if it, it also holds you back from innovation. So simply handing a consumer a mobile phone and saying, use this to pay for things, doesn't really, it's not that much better than what we've already got. So it takes more than that to drive behavioral change. So kind of
the phone certainly takes
the enemy
room in my wallet,
right?
Although not that much.
Yeah, it doesn't really save you that much time. So the wallet people, mobile wallet people are trying to think of, you know, dramatically different ways to increase security, convenience, and drive consumer adoption. So I can give one example.
Okay.
If you want.
Yep.
There's been a lot of buzz about this company called Square, and I think originally the buzz was because the CEO is a founder of Twitter, so, you know, he's a big name. And their first product was ubiquitous credit card acceptance in a cell phone, an app, you know, an iPhone. So they have a little Magstripe swipe device that goes into the microphone jack of the iPhone, and anybody, like a flea market vendor, can start accepting Magstripe cards, credit cards. So that's interesting, and you know, they got lots and lots of new merchants every month. But now their next innovation really turns payment acceptance on its head and dramatically improves convenience because it sort of throws out the whole old business model. And that is when you have your cell phone that's got a GPS chip in it and you walk into a merchant, say a coffee shop like a Starbucks type of thing, it recognizes that you're in the Starbucks and your picture pops up on the iPad. So when you go buy your
coffee,
kidding. You just say, my name's Deb and my name's Tay. And they see your picture there and they say, okay, and they add it to your account. You don't have to pull anything out. You don't have to tap a card or anything.
Holy
That's
cow.
That's amazing. Yeah.
So that's really amazing. I mean, I can't even get the farmers to accept a credit card, let alone a phone. So that's really changing very, very quickly. Now, what countries are on the cutting edge in payments?
Yeah, well, it's definitely not the U.S.
You're going to tell us about that in a bit, but who is?
Yeah, because we're held back by legacy. The good the enemy of the better. The first countries that were really innovative were Japan and South Korea, in kind of the developed market category. And then in the developing market categories, it was, well, also Turkey, I'd say, developed market. Developing was Kenya and the Philippines.
Okay.
Those five countries are the most innovative in terms of payments.
So let's start with Japan. I know Japan's been innovative on the hard tech side.
Yeah, well, they had a much faster early adoption of mobile phones than any other country. But I'd say part of the driver of innovation there was they kind of flattened the business model problem because there's one really large player, NTT, Nippon Telephone and Telegraph. So it's like AT&T, but they've got something like 80% market share in Japan. So they were able to make things happen, without a lot of dragging out of extensive, building of consortiums and talking to a lot of other players.
Korea? I know. You were going on about Japan. I thought you were.
Yeah. So they launched a mobile payments thing called Docomo.
Mm-hmm.
They have a version for teenagers. And they have a version for adults. They have different credit lines. And the regulators helped them because they allowed them to post purchases up to about $100 a month onto the cell phone bill. So that's kind of the teenager's version. They use that then to download, ringtones and music and that kind of thing, pictures. They also use it for gaming and virtual reality. So they've been doing all this stuff for 10 years before we even started thinking about it.
So we've got a couple minutes before we take our first break. Now, I know Korea was a pioneer in the use of smart cards, particularly in its healthcare industry, but what were they doing in terms of mobile payments?
They were one of the first to launch a real industrial strength TSM. TSM is Trusted Services Manager, and that is a new kind of ecosystem player that is needed to provision secure apps into the secure element of the phone. So anything that is has a high need for security, like a payment application or some sort of a banking application, you couldn't just download it like you do from the Apple iTunes store. It has to be, encrypted and kind of bulletproof. So they built that that had something like 12 banks, and 5 mobile operators at all. So they made it ubiquitous so that anybody with a cell phone that had the right kind of hardware to host a wallet could download the wallet for any mobile operator and for any bank. So they made it ubiquitous.
And is it universally accepted now in Korea?
They have something like, a million acceptance points for contactless, which would be what you would need to use that
cell
phone. Yeah.
So have they exported these apps? Has anybody else picked up on the Korean system?
Well, interestingly, First Data, about a year ago, formed a partnership with them to use their TSM software. So I don't think it's really been launched here yet in the U.S., but
it sounds like it's about to be.
That company in Korea is definitely trying to sell their software.
Okay. When we get back from break, I want to hear about Turkey, because I always think of Turkey as being sort of on the intersection not just of Europe and the Middle East, but on the intersection of the developed and the developing worlds. So we're going to go to break now, but stay tuned.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Hi, welcome back to Global Reach. This is your host, Tay Revez, and I'm here with my guest, Deb Baxley of Capgemini. Deborah, we were talking about Turkey when we left for the breach. You surprised me when you told me that Turkey was among the most innovative countries in the world. What are they doing?
Well, there's a funny story. A bank called Garanti Bank, G-A-R-A-N-T-I, their commercials are posted on YouTube, and I encourage people to go look at a couple of them because they're really funny. You know, even translated, they're very funny. They show a man who lost his wallet, and he's talking on the phone to his wife, and it's pouring down rain, and he doesn't have his wallet. He can't pay for a cab. So he calls his wife, and he says, "Honey, can you come pick me up? I lost my wallet." And she says, "Honey, I'm out of town. But I can send you money. Are you near a Garanti Bank ATM?" And of course he looks up and it's right next to him.
Of course.
And he says, "Yes, but how am I going to get, how's that going to help me?" And all of a sudden a code pops up on his phone and he's kind of mumbling to himself, "She's pulling my leg." He goes to the ATM, he types the code in and it spits the money out. So he didn't have a card or anything. She was able to transfer money to him through the cell phone out of a Garanti Bank ATM.
Wow.
So then he's got the money, and he's all happy that he can catch the cab, and the wind whips the money out of his hand and washes it down the storm drain.
Oh, no.
So they have a whole series of commercials like that. I think Turkey has kind of a unique set of circumstances where they used to have, you know, a traditional and somewhat state and closed banking system. And it's amazing the impact that regulators can have on innovation. The regulators open the market to foreign competition. And, you know, the amount of competition that the market was seeing from players like Citibank and HSBC really drove some of the, you know, the Turkish banks to be even more innovative because they wanted to, maintain their market share versus these foreign intruders. So Garanti Bank is probably the top of the list, but some of the other banks are very innovative as well.
That's really interesting. That says a lot about a whole lot of different international trade issues, actually. Listen, Deb, the network's just signaled me. We've got the NYPE president, David True, on the line, and he's got a question for us. David.
Okay, great.
Hey, David, how are you?
Hey, Deb, how are you guys doing? No, fascinating discussion. It's really, really interesting. One question I've got, which is one of the things I think about a lot is that One thing that's slowing down mobile payments is a lot of it's trying to be driven in developed markets. Kenya, which we'll get to in a minute, is another example, where they have to displace an existing payment methodology that people are happy with. So I know Korea and Japan, for various reasons, have gotten around, from various reasons you mentioned, and been able to implement a fair number of NFC-enabled phones. And you'd mentioned the number of terminals, but do you know how much they're used?
The guys from Docomo are very proud about this. And they have what they call a killer app, which is Transit, that works in, you know, in Tokyo. Everyone takes the subway or some kind of a commuter train. So they've tied the payment platform, kind of linked it to a transit platform. And they have a statistic which is pretty amazing, something like 30% of their people use it every single day, you know, and the average number of transactions is about 10 per month. So, you know, in a case like that where the transit is just sort of a natural driver, because then you can kind of launch off from that and you can use the same app to then buy your coffee, your newspaper, whatever it might be, and that drives behavioral change.
That's the thing that I noticed when there, and admittedly it was just for a couple of weeks tourist trip, it's used for transit but not for anything else. And so transit is a very good use case because there's a strong convenience for the customer, quickly getting through a turnstile, and there's a big savings for the transit authority. They can get away from paper or plastic tickets, whatever, and the transit authority can enable a whole bunch of places all at once. But the bleed over is the interesting one. And that's where my thinking these days, and this is recent, is that you're going to have a much greater likelihood of getting people to change behavior in a place where you don't have to displace something that works just as well. And you'll be talking about Kenya in a minute. That may be an example because there's a real need that was unmet that commerce with a mobile device is enabling, whereas in developed countries, there isn't really.
Yeah, you know, the landscape is littered with failed payment experiments, you know, that have been over the past 10, 15 years. But one that did have a huge adoption was PayPal. And it was for that very reason. It was meeting an unmet need, which is, you know, strangers having to pay each other for something over eBay or over the internet. And then they gradually grew from there. So I think your observation is right on, you know. Just tapping a mobile phone is not, it's maybe incrementally more convenient, maybe a little bit cooler than sliding a mag stripe, but it's not, that in and of itself is not going to drive behavioral change. We need other things, like the example that I was talking to Tay about before, which is you don't have to pull anything out. It just recognizes that you're in the store, and you say, put it on my tab, which is what Square is doing.
And the remarkable thing about that is that it bypasses NFC altogether, and all of this stuff that you mentioned in Turkey about the secure element, there isn't any. You just have an online cloud, nothing in the telephone, in the phone except for an app, and so you've bypassed all of that who owns the secure element.
That's right, yeah. I think there will be a battle royale between NFC and payments in the cloud in developed markets.
Hang on, Deborah. Could you define payments in the cloud, please?
Yeah, so the payments in the cloud is you've registered in advance with a host system. And so in that case of the Square example, the presence of the phone is important because it authenticates that you're actually at the merchant store, but that's through GPS. So it recognizes you, and then the actual payment transaction happens at the host level, as opposed to what we call, you know, proximity payment, which is your token, your card, your phone is interacting with the physical point of sale. That's a proximity payment. So that's the opposite of the payment in the cloud. So
and
those are
the host?
Two different approaches.
Who is the host?
The host system.
Okay.
So it would be, you know, it could be PayPal. That's the way they've implemented their mobile payment system is a cloud-based, and the cloud is owned by PayPal. In this other case, it's Square owns the cloud, the host.
Let me
take
way.
You to something more basic. We have readers who are not totally tech savvy.
fact, we got an email from China last week. They were listening at 3 a.m. But what define the cloud? Not you see the term, but not everybody knows exactly what it is.
It's a server.
Okay. Up there somewhere in the stratosphere?
Yeah, at the simplest point, it's just a bunch of servers. It's very analogous to when you buy something on the Internet, because the Internet doesn't know if you've got your credit card in your hand or not. So you're typing something in, either on your phone or on your computer, and it goes to, you know, a bank or Visa or something like that. So that's the cloud, and it returns an authorization.
Okay.
If you think about it this way, the big hump, the big challenge in my mind, is convincing a consumer to put their identification and payment information somewhere outside of their wallet, to key it in and give it to someone. Now, the difference between secure element and cloud is just where it lives. In one case, it lives in a little chip inside your telephone, the secure element. In the other case, the same information lives on a server, God knows where. But from the customer's point of view, the big thing is just deciding to put it somewhere. And the argument for the techies is, you know, where does it live?
But then I can definitely see a future where we have both. I think that these two models can cohabitate, as it were. You have examples now of like the Starbucks barcode payment app, which is kind of like a combination of those two approaches, because it's actually happening at Starbucks host location, which is where your credit card information is stored. But it's using a barcode to authenticate you at the point of sale. So I don't think it's going to be all one or the other. I think we're going to have a hybrid, you know, approach.
I think you're going to have, I completely agree, a very disaggregated market.
So, David, you brought up Kenya, and way back in January when Ron Mazursky and my other guests were on the show, we also talked about Kenya. Deborah, tell us exactly what is happening in Kenya. Why is it such a leading-edge country?
Well, it all started with their mobile operator called Safaricom, who had an idea to do mobile payments. But nothing would have happened if the banking regulators had not allowed them. So that's, you know, the point about regulation. Regulators can either stifle or underwrite innovation. And in that case, the banks didn't fight it, and the Safaricom was given permission to start a mobile payment service. It is not really banking, because the money that's put into the system does not accrue interest. It's just sort of a pool. It's very much the way our prepaid programs work in the U.S. So originally it was intended for P2P, person-to-person payments, to meet the unmet need. It was a very cash-based society. When people needed to send money to their homes, their families at home, because they work in the city, and actually the number one mechanism for sending money home before that was bus service or taxi service.
Huh.
There was a lot of robbery. So, you know, with the regulator behind them and the introduction of this very, very simple app, it doesn't require any kind of special phone. It's all based on basically text messages. It took off like wildfire, and now it's to the point where it's branched way beyond the original P2P. People now use it to pay the taxi driver, merchants, and the other important thing about M-Pesa was they have a huge human network of agents for cash in and cash out. So the velocity of this is very high. People don't leave their money in the M-Pesa network very long. They go to an agent, they give the cash over, they cash in, they send the money out over to whoever, and then that person cashes out at another agent.
Let me back up for just one second. Say I'm a market woman. I have my little stall in an outdoor market. How does that work for me with my customers? I mean, did I have to make a big investment in being able to receive their payments?
No. You just have to open an account. You have to have a cell phone. If I'm going to pay you, I send my text message to your ID, and then at the end of the day, you go to an agent and you get your cash out.
So I just need a cell phone. I don't need a terminal.
No, just a cell phone.
Okay.
And you may have heard of some in the U.S. which are using 7-Elevens as ways of picking up and getting your cash for people who don't go to ATMs or don't have ATM access. This is vaguely analogous in that the transfer of money takes place and you just have a pickup or drop-off point.
What kind of fees are involved for that person-to-person transaction or my, you know, customer-to-market woman transaction?
It's very reasonable. It's in the order of, you know, 5, 10, 15 cents, which is not totally insignificant, but it is an order of magnitude better than the alternatives of carrying cash and getting robbed, or some of the other alternative P2P. You know, like Western Union, they have a great business, but it costs $30 to send $200 to somebody. So that really adds up. So the fee structure that M-Pesa came up with is very reasonable and, you know, it seems fair.
And David, we're going to go to break now. But when we come back, we're going to continue this fascinating discussion. So stay tuned, everybody. We'll be back in 3 minutes or two.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
How can we Americans realize our dreams to earn a living? How can you pursue your dream and make money as an owner or an employee? Learn how at The American Business Person, the online weekly radio talk show hosted by Rich Killian. Today's business leaders share how to succeed and what fails. If you own a new or established business or ever hope to, you must tune in. Join us every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Central, and noon Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel or listen on demand to our archived shows.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm here with my guest, Deb Baxley from Capgemini. We were talking about the mobile payments revolution in Kenya and how mobile phone to mobile phone payments are revolutionizing the country, and I think it must be making things a lot easier for the people who live there. I understand they tried to do something similar in South Africa with less success. What went on in South Africa?
Well, there was a startup called Wizit, which was started by somebody who is socially responsible and was looking for to improve financial inclusion. So they had the best of intentions, and it was a very well thought out business model where they had the agents, the cash in, the cash out, and some very cute marketing ideas, like they had Wiz Kids who were supposed to sign people up and things like that. The difference was the regulators there and the fact that it was a bank-led model. And it just hasn't had the uptake as quickly as M-Pesa being a telephone company or mobile operator-led model.
Why?
So it seems that In every case, including Japan, South Korea, Philippines, and Kenya, that the mobile operator-led model has been more successful so far. That's bad news for my bank customers, but it's just something that we're going to have to overcome. I think the reason is they didn't, in South Africa, were not able to launch as many of these human agents, the cash in, the cash out. They weren't able to deploy, you know, the acceptance devices or get the cooperation from the mobile operators. So, you know, they're still trying, but M-Pesa was much faster adoption.
You think we have any chance of adopting that, the M-Pesa model at all in the U.S.? I know we're always talking about the unbanked and the underbanked. Could they benefit from an M-Pesa-type model?
Well, like we were talking before, I think what we'll end up with is a hybrid set of combination of approaches in developed markets like the U.S. So there could be some adoption of an M-Pesa-like model, but I don't think it's going to be as ubiquitous or widespread as it was in Kenya, because we've got this competing legacy system at, you know, 6 million merchants across the country that are accustomed to accepting bank cards. And I think it's somewhat unlikely that any significant proportion of those merchants will accept text message payments. It'll be, you know, a kind of a niche thing.
You are at a conference in Australia. What's going on with mobile payments down under?
Yeah, it's a very similar situation to the U.S., just on a smaller scale. With although the banking structure there is a lot simpler, there's four, it's kind of an oligopoly of four or five large banks. they are starting an NFC pilot, you know, very similar to our ISIS pilot. But I'd say that Canada, Australia, the U.S., and a lot of Europe is facing pretty much the same problem, which is the more mouths to feed problem.
And more mouths to feed, you mean what exactly?
Well, there's a fixed amount of money to be made from payments, and the banks and the networks, Visa and MasterCard, have, you know, for years they've divvied it up. If you now have to pay a mobile operator, a telephone company, or a handset manufacturer, or somebody else, like an iTunes, to split up part of the revenue, then you've got the same amount of revenue, but more mouths to feed. So the trick to that is to figure out, is there additional revenue that could be made? So that would be a little bit like the Google Wallet model. They say that they're not taking any of the existing revenue. They're going to get new revenue from, you know, marketing, advertising, like they do on the Internet. Now, there is a case, which is an interesting microcosm, in Holland. They call it the six-pack.
Six-pack?
Yeah, the six-pack. Like,
oh, it's a beer-loving culture.
Yeah, I know, I know. that's not the real name, but that's the nickname, and it kind of stuck. It's the three mobile operators and the three banks. And together, those six players have something like 80 to 90% of the Dutch market.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're trying to figure out, just like we have ISIS in the U.S., they're trying to figure out how to do their NFC wallet. And what they're being bogged down on is they haven't even gotten to the revenue yet. They're trying to figure out how their business processes will work. So exactly who sends the payment application into the handset? Who's responsible for that? And how do they get paid for that? And then, you know, if you're signing up a new customer, who accepts the application? Who's responsible for that? Who's responsible for their credit riskiness and their underwriting? It's just an order of magnitude more complicated than our existing credit card model because of the more players. And that's what they've gotten bogged down into. Now, something interesting happened a couple of months ago, that the Dutch anti-competitive authority shut them down, the six-pack, temporarily, and said, you know, we think maybe you're price fixing or something. So they put everything on hold until this month is supposed to be their ruling in April. So we'll find out what happens. And then in the meantime, one of the operators dropped out. So now it's just a five-pack, which doesn't have the same ring to it anymore, does it?
No. Maybe they should call themselves the Pentagon.
Right.
With all of this, I hear this recurring theme about regulators. So how exactly are the regulators going to help or harm innovation?
Yeah, well, the common themes that regulators can help is to set a consistent and well-understood set of ground rules.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to know what the regulation is, right?
Uh-huh.
And then to, as they did in Kenya, to be willing to be flexible and allowing, you know, kind of open-minded to allowing a new business model, which kind of benefits, where they look at their job as benefiting the overall payments infrastructure, making it safe and secure, and benefiting the end stakeholders, being the consumers. That's what would help regulation, help innovation.
So, you know, you listen to this, you've got the banks, you've got the telcos, you've got the regulators, and somewhere in the middle of all this are the customers. What, how are we all supposed to make sense of this? Because every single country you're going to, you've got a different payment system, and different hardware, different apps. So how is this all going to benefit us, and what can we do to make sense of it?
Well, there are a lot of regulatory bodies, which, especially for the developed markets, and for if we're tourists going to, you know, business travelers going to different countries, they have fulfilled the promise of global acceptance, common acceptance of payments for the past 30 years with the Visa and MasterCard and other networks. So, but there are other standards bodies like EMVCo and Global Platform, which, you know, once some of these new payment types start to evolve, if they meet those global interoperable standards, then that will certainly help consumers as they're traveling across different countries. It doesn't cover everything, but if people are adhering to NFC and EMV, which we haven't talked about yet, but it's a security standard for chip-based payments, and global platform, which has to do with the cell phones, then we will continue to be interoperable, just like our text messages are interoperable today. And, you know, that is the goal of the industry, to remain globally interoperable. You don't want a bunch of islands that don't work together.
No, in fact, that leads me to another question. You've written about the fact that one of the things that's holding back innovation and making it much harder for all of us to use mobile payments is the fact that you have all these forces competing against each other, and what's really needed is a cooperative model. What's the ideal cooperative model? What are you positing?
Well, I would see it very much like Apple iTunes. Now, I know iTunes Store is a proprietary platform, but they threw it open within certain criteria to a lot of developers, and it unleashed a flood of innovation. Who would have thought of all of the cool things that you could do with a phone? Like, remember when camera phones first came out? You think, you know, that's nice. What am I? I could take a picture. What's the big deal? And now all the things we do with the camera that you never would have dreamed of. So I think something very similar can happen with NFC once the cooperative model is out there. And the cooperative model is, just as we were talking about before, the more mouths to feed, where the mobile operators, the banks, come up with a model where everyone can play together and they don't over-worry or over-protect their revenue model. If you worry too much about cannibalization or loss of revenue, then you're not going to go anywhere. You just sort of have to jump into the game and expect that the size of the revenue pie is going to grow over time, rather than trying to protect your slice of a diminishing pie. And those new revenue sources will be things like marketing, location-based services, lost phone services, fees for new kind of services on the phone that, you know, people really want to and are willing to pay for.
We've got to go to break now. But when we come back,
want you to summarize what it really takes to make innovation successful. Don't go away.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Are you an entrepreneur that wants to achieve more? Not just in it for profit, but to do work you find meaningful, that adds more value to more people in more ways? Listen for Be More, Achieve More, Inspiration for the Entrepreneurial Mind with host Chris Cooper. You'll hear from successful achievers from around the world with the passion and experience to offer invaluable guidance. These people are making a difference and will help give you the motivation and insight to achieve more. Be More, Achieve More can be heard live Fridays at 8 a.m. U.S. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone, and I'm here with my guest, Deb Baxley from Capgemini. Deborah, when we were talking about all these changes in Turkey and especially in Kenya, it strikes me that these innovations are truly transforming people's lives, but also strikes me, particularly in Kenya, that there must be a jobs multiplier effect, and it must be having an impact on the economy because you speeded up commerce. Have you seen any evidence of that, or is that just a guess?
No, it's a good guess, Tay. The World Bank has done some studies that correlate growth of GDP with growth in cell phone penetration. I imagine that might be true for other technologies as well, but there is a very strong correlation just with that technology, cell phones and GDP growth, because it does grease the wheels of commerce.
I mean, I've also heard anecdotal evidence or cases about, for example, rural farmers who are using their mobile phones to get crop forecasts, to get price forecasts. So it's a very...
Yeah, there was a lot of case studies of that in India. They can do spot check prices on the what their price of their crop can be, and it dramatically changed the way they do business. It cut out the middleman. It created transparency. You know, it gives more freedom to decide when they're going to take their crops to market based on the prices they can get. It's been a wonderful transformation.
So what can the developed markets learn from these developing markets?
Well, the keys to innovation being adherence to open standards so that you've got interoperability, collaboration, the collaborative business model, not a single player trying to go it alone. It's never going to work. You lose the network effect. And I think most importantly, to just get out there. And it's a lot like Steve Jobs' story, you know, where he would put innovations out there just based on a face and that he knew what consumers wanted. Whereas, you know, the opposite of that is over-worrying your revenue, your existing business, worrying too much about cannibalization. I think you have to plan for cannibalization to catch the next wave of innovation and avoid, you know, becoming a dinosaur. That's, I think, what we can learn from those markets.
Sounds a little like a study I did some years ago on how you get your technology accepted as the industry standard. And one of the real keys was to get stakeholders both on your supply side and really, you know, open your application so a lot of people could make money off of it so they'd adopt it as well as on the customer side.
Or even giving your stuff away in some cases.
Adobe did that, I think. Was Adobe or Cisco opened their app and let a lot of people sign on, and we saw how successful they were.
Yeah.
Deborah, you're an officer in the Smart Card Alliance. We had Randy Vanderhoff on the show in January, and he was talking a bit about smart cards and payments. But in terms of all we've been talking about in innovation, is there a central role for smart cards as opposed to cell phones?
Well, smart cards are kind of an old term because the form factor is kind of disappearing, and there's a convergence of cell phones, at least the NFC part of the cell phone, and smart cards, because that the chip that's in the NFC, the secure element, is actually a smart card. You can think of it as a smart card. But the coolest, or the things that we're most worried about, at least in the U.S. right now, with smart cards, traditional plastic cards, is EMV, which is that security standard. And it's a little bit like the metric system for us because the rest of the world has adopted EMV, which is kind of a bulletproof. You can't counterfeit the card. You can't hack the card. We have all these incidents of hacking. It wouldn't work anymore. But we haven't adopted yet. No, we're just beginning kind of that adoption phase for EMV so we can catch up with the rest of the world on the security standard.
Okay. You're involved in a lot of organizations. The other one that I know you were one of the co-founders is something called 1 Million Acts of Payment Innovation. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that our listeners would be particularly interested in?
Yeah, we had a lot of university college students come in and talk about, business executives, their view of payments and social media. And there were some interesting findings there. In some cases, the college students are a lot more savvy about the importance of reputation and security and trustworthiness of a bank than they are some other, you know, startup player. So some of the students say they would not necessarily trust, you know, a new startup of some kind as much as they would trust a bank with their payment credentials. So that was interesting. Give them students credit for being more savvy than we thought. They also expect banks who I work with to be active on social media, and there's kind of a saying for banks or any business, actually, you're in social media whether you like it or not. You can sort of stick your head in the sand, but people are out there talking about you, so it behooves you to get active and start to manage your reputation and start customer dialogues, not just broadcast, but it's also listening with social media.
I have a question. In all of what's going on in terms of the payment revolution, what are the things our listeners could do to have input into creating a win-win-win payments model? You've described the cooperative model, which I assume is the win-win-win model. What can our listeners do who are not necessarily payments professionals?
Well, one little thing I always do, it's small, but whenever I see a merchant that has a contactless terminal, I make a point of using my contactless credit card to make that transaction because, believe it or not, every single contactless transaction that all of us do is one less opportunity for criminals to steal your credit card information because that contactless transaction is not hackable.
Really? It's actually more secure than the swipe?
It is much more secure.
Huh. That's really interesting.
Yeah, a little known fact.
Very little known fact. So
Another of your organizations, kind of amazing you are on so many. You're on the advisory board of something called Brighter Planet. In about 1 minute, what is it? And should our listeners be interested in it?
Yeah, it's a socially conscious startup that is trying to help consumers and companies manage carbon emissions. So it uses data streams from credit card transactions or also from travel transactions, so you can apply this to travel sites as well, to deliver back reports on what your carbon footprint is. So like if you were comparing two different airline flights, you could choose the one that has the lower carbon footprint.
Huh.
And it allows consumers as well as companies to then buy carbon offsets to neutralize their carbon footprint. So it's a way of calculating carbon footprint. It's pretty cool stuff. It's all based on sophisticated data mining.
That's really, really interesting. What's the website? Is there a website for that?
Yeah, it's brighterplanet.com.
Okay. Now, you're in NYPAE. I'm involved in NYPAE. David's the president of NYPAE. We've got a really interesting event coming up on May 21st that will be open to any of our listeners who will be in New York City. Could you tell us a little bit about it, quickly?
Yes, an investor's view of payments, opportunities, and risks. So we have several different stakeholders. Robert Pack, who's the president of CoRise, which is a merchant bank. Hans Morris from General Atlantic, who's a PE firm. We have Roger Desai, who's the CEO, and he's like a serial entrepreneur, CEO of a payment startup. And we're going to also have a equity analyst and probably a venture capital firm, too. And they're going to talk about what's hot in payments, what do investors look for, you know, what are some of the unmet needs and some of the white spaces in payments. So it promises to be another sold-out event that NYPAE traditionally has.
But really interesting from both a startup perspective and an investor perspective, as well as payment industry.
That's right.
If you want to find out about it, you can go to the NYPAE Group site on LinkedIn, or you can email me, trr@globalreach-sbi.com, or link on my host page on the Voice America website. And if anybody would like to suggest a topic or a guest for a future episode, let me know. Deb, we've got 1 minute left. What's the one most important takeaway that our listeners should get from the show?
I'd say, you know, the transformational power of mobile technology and how it's going to improve all of our lives, not just with payments, but with a lot of other things, and greasing the wheels of commerce and making an opportunity to make the lives better for the entire world.
That's great. Deborah, thank you. This has been fascinating, informative. Love you back on the show another time. Meanwhile,
thanks so much, Kay. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Meanwhile, to our listeners, if you'd like to suggest a topic or a guest for a future episode, let me know. And for me and for my guest, Deb Baxley, we wish you great success in extending your global reach.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.